audio and visual wise is okay tonight. And the first thing I want to bring up is there are two mainstream authors. James McPherson is one who wrote a book called on Lincoln's Second American Revolution. And George Fletcher is another one. He wrote a book called Our Secret Constitution. And the gist of these two books is that these liberal and leftist academics celebrate the fact that there was a sort of a de facto overthrowing of the Constitution during the Civil War without the formal amendment process. There were amendments after the war, but the behavior of Lincoln during the war is praised by a lot of writers on the left and the right, that from the neoconservatives who praise Lincoln's unconstitutional behavior. For example, Michelle Malkin, the neoconservative author, wrote a book in defense of internment, in which she argued in favor of rounding up Muslim Americans and putting them in concentration camps. And of course, she cited Lincoln as her source because Lincoln did similar things with his northern state opposition during his time. And even Musharraf, the former dictator of Pakistan, when he declared martial law in his country, he made a speech saying, well, Abraham Lincoln did this, so therefore I should be able to do it. It's as though they're saying, well, God did this, therefore how could it be wrong for me to do this? And you can look up Musharraf, there are articles in the New York Times and all over at the time when he did that. If you just type in Musharraf and Lincoln and martial law, you'll find it. And so, and even during Lincoln's time, people were calling him a dictator, and generations of American historians called him a dictator. And so it wasn't even controversial for many, many decades that the Constitution was trashed and suspended during the Lincoln regime and created many bad precedents in the eyes of those who would prefer to see the Constitution enforced and government limited. And it's also true that the advocates of bigger government, whether they want bigger government for the welfare state or the warfare state, often voice approval of this, and I'll give some examples as we go. And so I'm going to talk about the ways in which, some of the ways in which Lincoln ignored or, as I say, trashed the Constitution and established precedents for future presidents up to this day to ignore the Constitution. And of course, it's not an accident, it's not just coincidence, that modern-day politicians often cite Abe Lincoln when they want to ignore the Constitution, spy on us, monitor the internet, do all these things by saying it was done in his time. And I'll start with Article 3, Section 3 of the United States Constitution, which I put on the reading list. And this is the definition of treason under the United States Constitution. And it defines treason as only, it uses the word only, levying war upon the United States or giving aid and comfort to their enemies. And the word their is all important here because the phrase United States is in the plural. And the phrase United States is in the plural in all the founding documents, in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation. When King George III signed the peace treaty to end the Revolutionary War, he did not sign a treaty with something called the United States government. He signed a treaty with all of the individual states, and they were named individually, Virginia, Massachusetts, New York, Rhode Island, and plantations, and on and on and on. And so there was no such thing as the United States in the singular until after the Civil War. And so getting back to Article 3, Section 3, the definition of treason is only defined. Only, of course, means nothing else. No other interpretation is possible as levying war upon the states. And that, of course, is exactly what Lincoln's invasion did. It was levying war upon the United States. And so when the phrase United States was used in all these documents, the original founding documents, it meant the free and independent states were united in a particular purpose. And this purpose delegating, in the Constitution's purpose, delegating certain powers to the central government for the mutual benefit of the states. The government, the federal government, was of course set up as the agent of the citizens of the states. That was the original idea. And so the war, the waging war in the southern states was treason, but Lincoln redefined treason himself. He took it upon himself. He did not amend the Constitution. It's still in there in the Constitution. But he just declared that treason meant criticism of him and his administration. And this was not his idea either. In my studies and my research, I found that the nationalists in American politics, beginning with Hamilton, Joseph Story, John Marshall, people of that sort, made this argument 30, 40, 50 years before Lincoln became president, that treason was somehow opposition to the federal government. But that's not what the Constitution says. It says only levying war upon the states. And so right then and there, you have a crushing of one of the major principles of the Constitution. Lincoln also repudiated all of the major principles of the Declaration of Independence. And one of the most bizarre things about the so-called Lincoln scholarship is that Lincoln himself tried to twist the meaning of the words of the Declaration of Independence to make it an anti-secessionist document. And ever since then, for the past 150 years, various propagandists, such as the people at the Claremont Institute or Hillsdale College, have simply repeated over and over and over and over again the same old lawyerly, slick lawyerly arguments that that Lincoln made. And they were very brief arguments. But the reality, of course, is that the American Declaration of Independence was a declaration of secession from the British Empire. The colonists seceded from the British Empire. They separated from the British Empire. And the declaration was their announcement that they were doing so. And so to call this an anti-secessionist document is like saying black is white, night is day, up is down. And that's the business that Hillsdale College is apparently in teaching courses on Lincoln. And of course, they are controlled now by the so-called Straussian neocons, who their shrine is a Lincoln statue on the campus of Hillsdale College. And so that's point number one about the declaration. It was a declaration of secession. And so in no way can it be interpreted as an anti-secessionist document. And the main principle, one of the main principles, of course, is that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. And that whenever that consent is withdrawn, then it is the duty, the declaration, the duty of the citizens to abolish that government and replace it with a new one. That's what the colonists were doing. And this is why in my writings, in my books on Lincoln, I cite a big two-volume set of books entitled Northern Editorials on Secession by Joseph Cecil Perkins. And what he shows in that book, it's a collection of hundreds of newspaper editorials from the northern states in America in 1859 to 1861. And the overwhelming majority of them spoke out in favor of peaceful secession. And most of them cited Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence as saying, governments just powers are derived from the consent of the governed, and when that consent is withdrawn, then they have a duty to abolish that government. And so this was the common belief in the North at the time and in the South. The Declaration of Independence in the last several paragraphs also refers to the states as free and independent states. And it says, free and independent to do what? Free and independent to raise taxes, to wage war, and do all the other things that states can do. And so the way in which the founders viewed the states as free and independent was that each state, Virginia, Massachusetts, New York, Rhode Island, was a sovereign state in the same sense that Great Britain, France, and Spain were sovereign states. They were the sovereigns, they created the Constitution, and they ratified the Constitution. And of course, several states, in ratifying the Constitution, explicitly reserved the right. Virginia was one of them, Rhode Island was another one of them, explicitly reserved the right to withdraw from the union in the future if they thought the union was no longer protecting their rights. And there's a doctrine in the law that says that that no one state can have more rights. The citizens of any one state in America can have no more rights than the citizens of any other state. And so when these states were accepted into the union, it was assumed by everyone that these provisions that we could take back the delegated powers that we have delegated to the federal government applied to all the states and all the new states, all the new states that would come in the future after the original 13. Lincoln totally repudiated the Declaration of Independence. If you look at the part of the Declaration that talks about the train of abuses, this is where Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, went down a list of complaints against King George III. And I'm going to go through some of them and discuss how Lincoln did the exact same thing during his administration. Therefore, by his actions, not just his fanciful rhetoric, that's what the Hillsdale College Claremont Institute crowd focuses on. Only a few of Lincoln's prettier sounding speeches, while ignoring actual history and his behavior in office. Jefferson wrote this in the Declaration, complaining about King George III. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly, proposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected. Well, Lincoln imposed military rule on those parts of the South that were conquered territory during the war and for 12 years after the war, so he did the exact same thing. Jefferson wrote, King George has made judges dependent on his will alone. While Lincoln illegally suspended the writ of habeas corpus, ignoring the Supreme Court, which told him it was illegal to do so, and had the military mass arrest tens of thousands of Northern political dissenters. Jefferson wrote, King George has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Well, during the Lincoln regime, dozens of new bureaucracies were created to run the occupied states during the war and during Reconstruction after the war. And so the exact same thing happened. King George, quote, has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. This is exactly what happened for 12 years after the war during Reconstruction, one of the legacies of the Lincoln regime. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. Well, that's from the Declaration. This was a consequence of Lincoln's four-year suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, whereby the military arrested tens of thousands of northern state civilians, including a member of Congress, the mayor of Baltimore, dozens of newspaper editors and owners, without any due process. King George was condemned in the Declaration because, quote, he has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. Well, Lincoln's assault on constitutional liberties in the North would be consistent with this, as would his unconstitutional naval blockade of the Southern ports, starting a war without the consent of Congress, and myriad other acts. And all these things that Lincoln did, which I'm going to talk about in more detail in a minute, were considered by the historian Clinton Rossiter, who wrote a book on called Constitutional Dictatorship. He said these acts were, quote, considered by nobody as legal. King George was condemned for, quote, quartering large bodies of armed troops among us. Well, this is self-explanatory. This happened in the South during and after the war. Quote, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, Lincoln imposed a trade embargo on the Southern states. Quote, for imposing taxes on us without consent. Well, Southern protests over protectionist tariffs were one of the major reasons for the war. You can make an argument that the main purpose of the war was not just to hold the Union together, but to hold the Union together so that the tariff tax could be collected in all the ports, Southern as well as Northern. King George was condemned, quote, for depriving us in many cases of the right of trial by jury. Well, as I said, Lincoln and the Congress suspended habeas corpus. There was no trial by jury. And so this is a perfect description of what happened. Again, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally our own legislatures, and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. Well, this is a perfect description of Reconstruction. And so I would argue that Lincoln's behavior and his legacy during Reconstruction led to a demolition of most of the main features of the Declaration of Independence, which after all is one of the first law listed in the code, the legal code of the United States. And for generations, left-wing historians have praised all of this. They've praised Lincoln as being a good dictator. Let me read you one of these things, give you an idea of how the so-called Lincoln scholars treat this. Here's a historian, a famous 20th century historian, early 20th century historian, was James Ford Rhodes. He wrote a big long, I think a 22-volume history of America up to that point. And he wrote this: never had the power of a dictator fallen into safer and nobler hands, writing about Lincoln. Then James Randall, who I mentioned before the class on the chat, James Randall was the preeminent Lincoln scholar of the mid-20th century. He taught at the University of Illinois for many years. He said this in one of his books: if Lincoln was a dictator, it must be admitted that he was a benevolent dictator. And so Lincoln's defenders call him a dictator. It's not me alone. It's his defenders calling him a dictator, but a good dictator. And of course, the United States Constitution does not allow anywhere for the creation of a dictatorship, even if left-wing historians call it a good dictatorship. It's still a dictatorship. And so why did they do this? You know, what are some of the things, some of the other things Lincoln did that caused his defenders to call him a dictator? And by the way, one of the more ridiculous defenses of him made by James Randall is that, writing in the 1950s, James Randall defended Lincoln by saying that while his abuses were not as bad as the ones we're seeing today in the Soviet Union and places of that sort under totalitarian communism. So he wasn't as bad as Stalin, in other words, was the sort of a canned defense of Lincoln and the Constitution for generations. Well, the suspension of habeas corpus. Lincoln took it on himself to suspend habeas corpus and have the military begin imprisoning political dissenters in the northern states. And this included dozens of newspaper editors and owners. It included the mayor of Baltimore, Congressman Henry May from the state of Maryland, Francis Scott Key, who was the grandson of Francis Scott Key, who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, was a newspaper editor in Baltimore, Maryland at the time, and he was imprisoned without due process. And so Congress later rubber-stamped this, but the history books tell you that there were as many as 30,000 Northern civilians. These were not spies. These were not Confederate soldiers. These were not Confederate spies. These were civilians, politicians, newspaper editors, from the northern states. As I said, Lincoln took it upon himself to redefine treason as simply opposition to him. He even made one speech in which he said, if a man remains quiet when his administration is being discussed in public, that's treasonous. So if you don't say anything, if you just shut up, that's treason, possibly. There was also a Confiscation Act that was passed by the U.S. Congress. And one of the provisions of the Confiscation Act said that if someone turned in another person, another citizen, for speaking out against the war, saying such things as overstating the successes of the enemies, that was part of the Confiscation Act. If you were overheard saying something like that in public, that all of your personal property could be confiscated by the U.S. government. You are put in jail, and the person who turned you in gets to keep 50% of your personal property. That was law during the Lincoln regime. And so there were tens of thousands of political dissenters thrown into dungeons, places like Fort Lafayette in New York Harbor. You can go online and type in Fort Lafayette and see a picture of this very gloomy-looking place. The Chief Justice of the United States at the time was Roger B. Taney. Roger B. Taney issued an opinion as a circuit court judge, which the Supreme Court judges also were at the time, saying that the suspension of habeas corpus by Lincoln was illegal because the Constitution only allows for Congress to do this. Not that that's a great defense of freedom, but it's a legal argument. It's the Constitution does place the suspension of habeas corpus under the congressional powers, not the executive powers. And Taney cited British legal history, and he cited other predecessors on the Supreme Court, such as Joseph Story, John Marshall, and others who all agreed with this. And it was also true that the writ of habeas corpus could only be legally suspended, even by Congress, if the civil courts are not operating. And the civil courts were operating in the northern states for the duration of the war. And so it was not legal for anybody, Congress or Lincoln, to suspend habeas corpus, but they did. Lincoln responded by issuing an arrest warrant for Judge Taney, who was 83 years old at the time. And this information first came about from one of Lincoln's White House legal consultants, a man named Ward Lehman. He was a lawyer. He was one of Lincoln's friends. He worked for Lincoln in the White House. The Lincoln defenders, the Lincoln cult, as I call it, immediately started saying, well, Ward Lehman was a drunk. You can't rely on what he says. Of course, all the historians say Ulysses S. Grant was a drunk also, but he's praised for doing that. However, there are several other corroborating books that show that this did in fact happen. There was an arrest warrant. One is A History of the Federal Marshal Service that makes note of the arrest warrant. Another is the biography of George Brown, who was the mayor of Baltimore at the time, who knew Taney and who knew that there had been an arrest warrant for him. And the third one was Benjamin Robbins Curtis's memoirs. Benjamin Robbins Curtis was a Supreme Court justice who wrote the dissenting opinion in the famous Dred Scott case, in which the Supreme Court said that the slaves did not deserve the rights of white people, to put it in a nutshell. They didn't say it exactly those words, but that's what the majority said. Benjamin Robbins Curtis wrote the dissent and then resigned from the Supreme Court. In his memoirs, he knew Taney very well. He served with him on the Supreme Court, and he said he was aware of the arrest warrant. And so this did happen. So, I also document in my book, Lincoln Unmasked, that other federal judges were harassed in this way, where Lincoln sent soldiers to the judge's home to essentially kidnap him or force him to stay at home so that he could not go to court and issue a writ of habeas corpus to someone who had been accused by the military of criticizing the Lincoln administration. And so this happened quite frequently. And that was an attack on the separation of powers. That was an executive dictatorship in action, in an attack on the separation of powers. Now, one of the most powerful Supreme Court statements ever made, in my opinion, was a case called Ex Parte Milligan, M-I-L-L-I-G-A-N, 1866. Lincoln is dead. He's gone. The war is over. And the Supreme Court, once again, has the nerve to criticize the government when it behaves in an unconstitutional manner. Here's what the United States Supreme Court in Ex Parte Milligan said about this, about the illegal suspension of habeas corpus during the Lincoln regime. The Constitution of the United States is a law for rulers and people, equally in war and peace, and it covers with its shield of protection all classes of men at all times and under all circumstances. No doctrine involving more pernicious consequences was ever invented by the wit of men that any of its great provisions can be suspended during any of the great exigencies of government, end quote. So the Constitution applies to all men, even Abe Lincoln, at all times, and nothing is more pernicious, the Supreme Court said, than using war as an excuse to destroy personal liberty. And if only the government had would pay attention to that. And so that's what the Supreme Court, which at that time included several Lincoln appointees, said. Now, another thing that Lincoln did was, you know, the Constitution says that the president has an obligation to assure that the states have a Republican form of government, a Republican form with a small r. But in the state of Maryland, Lincoln arrested several, had the military arrest and imprison several dozen members of the state legislature without due process because he did not want them to meet to discuss secession. And he threatened to bomb the cities, threatened to bomb Frederick and Baltimore and Annapolis if the legislature did meet. So the legislators fled to Frederick, Maryland, and the soldiers rounded them up and put them in a prison without due process. And so that was another attack on the Constitution. And the one of the books that I mentioned that talks about all of these things is Freedom Under Lincoln by Dean Sprague, S-P-R-A-G-U-E. And here's one of the conclusions that Dean Sprague came about the implications of these sorts of things. He says, at the outbreak of the war, the federal government was not a real source of power. But when the arm of the Lincoln administration reached into Cooperstown, New York, and took away George Brown, when it slipped into Freedom, Maine, and spirited away Robert Elliott, he's talking about people who were thrown in the dungeons of the Lincoln administration without due process. When it proved powerful enough to send three citizens of North Branch, Michigan, to Fort Lafayette, and in prison without any recourse to law, a man in Des Moines, Iowa, it was apparent that the federal executive had real power. The balance of power inexorably changed and altered the fundamental workings of the American political system. Quote, Father Abraham, end quote, had been born to the American people. That's the way Dean Sprague put it. Another thing Lincoln did was to rig Northern elections. Soldiers were instructed to intimidate Democratic Party voters. The ballots were printed in different colors so the soldiers could identify who was a Democrat, who was a Republican. Lincoln did his best, and his administration did their best to furlough Republican soldiers who were registered as Republican voters and to keep the Democratic Party voters out of the field during the war. And so that sort of thing happened. They created several states, Nevada and West Virginia, which gave the Republican Party additional Electoral College votes in the 1864 election. And these governments, state governments, were run out of the environs of Washington, D.C. by the Republican Party. According to James Randall's book, Constitutional Problems Under Lincoln, and Dean Sprague's book, Freedom Under Lincoln, over 300 northern newspapers were shut down. The editors and owners were often arrested and imprisoned themselves, and roving mobs of Republican Party hacks often literally destroyed the printing presses. That's why this book, I put this book on the reading list this evening, Lincoln's Wrath. It's by two historians, two well-known historians, Jeffrey Manber and Neil Dahlstrom. The subtitle is Fierce Mob, Brilliant Scoundrels, and a President's Mission to Destroy the Press. And so they did do a great deal to destroy the press. So they didn't destroy every single newspaper in the northern states, but certainly they intimidated every single newspaper editor in the United States. And so free speech went down the tubes. The telegraphs were censored. All telegraph communication was censored as well. The Lincoln administration brought the last slave state into the Union, West Virginia, and it illegally created the new state of West Virginia. The Constitution discusses this. The United States Constitution says to create a new state out of an existing state requires the cooperation of the governor and the legislature of that state, and of course the governor of Virginia and the legislature of Virginia did not agree to doing that. But again, the government of West Virginia was run out of the Republican Party headquarters in Alexandria, Virginia, not in West Virginia, and it gave the Republican Party several extra electoral college votes in the 1864 election. And of course, it was a slave state, and the Emancipation Proclamation explicitly omits West Virginia from its purview, because Lincoln's position was always, you can keep your slaves forever as long as you stay in the Union and keep paying federal taxes. That was always his position. Lincoln famously deported the most outspoken member of the Democratic Party during this time, a congressman from Dayton, Ohio named Clement Vallandigham. And Clement Vallandigham in Congress made many fiery speeches criticizing the illegal suspension of habeas corpus, the mass arrest of people in Ohio, his state, and other northern states, and so forth. And I'll give you a few examples of some of the things Vallandigham had been saying. But he criticized Lincoln's first inaugural address. He said it was, quote, spoken with the forked tongue and crooked counsel of the New York politician, leaving 30 millions of people in doubt whether it meant peace or war. I suspect when he said New York politician, he was aware of the fact that Lincoln's campaign manager was a man named Thurlow Weed from New York. Clement Vallandigham denounced the keystone of the Republican Party platform, the moral tariff, the protectionist tariff, as, quote, obscure, ill-considered, ill-digested, and unstatesmanlike. He condemned the Lincoln administration for what he said were, quote, persistent infractions of the Constitution and its high-minded usurpations of power, which formed any part of a deliberate conspiracy to overthrow the present form of federal Republican government and to establish a strong centralized government in its stead. That, of course, is exactly what happened. Vallandigham knew what was up, and that's why he was deported, in my view. Vallandigham continued to say that Lincoln's actions were, quote, wicked and cunning and constitution, a dangerous violation of that very Constitution, which this war is professedly waged to support. Starting a war without the consent of Congress is the kind of act that would have cost any English sovereign his head at any time in the last 200 years, said Clement Vallandigham. And then he went on, I'll continue this, because I think this is important. He was like, the heart of the matter, he said, was, you know, what is this war about? He said, well, it's about establishing national banks, bankrupt laws, a vast and permanent public debt, high tariffs, heavy direct taxation, enormous expenditure, gigantic and stupendous peculation, and strong government. No more state lines, no more state government, and a consolidated monarchy or vast centralized military despotism. Sounds like modern American government, doesn't it? That's what Vallandigham was complaining about. And Vallandigham was first gerrymandered out of his seat in Congress by the Republican Party. And so he went back home to Dayton, Ohio to run for governor of Ohio. And he was out on the stump making speeches. And the military, one morning in April of 1863, 67 heavily armed soldiers broke into his home, dragged him out of there, and ceremonially handed him over to a Confederate commander in Tennessee. And then the Republican Party issued press releases claiming he was a traitor, and so we gave him to his people. We gave him over to the Confederates. But of course, the Confederates did not want him. Vallandigham was arguing for a peaceful reuniting of the two sections of the country. And after their cities being bombed and plundered, and their women being raped and pillaged by the Lincoln regime for 2 years, 2.5 years, the Confederates wanted nothing to do with reuniting with the Lincoln administration. And so they told Vallandigham to get lost, and he went to Canada. And he spent the rest of the war years in Canada. And the Republican Party propaganda organ something called the Union League started making up tall tales about Vallandigham being some sort of Wizard of Oz type character orchestrating the draft riots in New York City and things like this. And this has all been proven to be bogus, you know, many, many years ago. But that's what happened. That's the sort of thing that happened. And so to cite Dean Sprague again on all of this, about the mass arrest of political dissenters, and even, you know, the thing about Vallandigham's deportation, this was another attack on the separation of powers. It told all other members of Congress, if you criticize the administration, you too can be deported. And of course, there was the arrest warrant for the Supreme Court justice. You know, federal judges, if you issue writs of habeas corpus, you too may be in trouble. That was the message they were being given. It was the destruction of the separation of powers, which is supposedly one of the key elements of the Constitution. So here's what Dean Sprague said. Now, Dean Sprague is not a Lincoln critic like me. He's an honest scholar. He documents all of these things that happened in history. But the last chapter of his book is called Lincoln the Humanitarian. And here's what he says about this whole process of behavior, this unconstitutional behavior. He says, the entire judicial system was set aside. The laws were silent. Indictments were not found. Testimony was not taken. Judges did not sit. Juries were not impaneled. Convictions were not obtained and sentences were not pronounced. The Anglo-Saxon concept of due process, perhaps the greatest political triumph of the ages and the best guardian of freedom, was abandoned. End quote. And so this made it that much easier during World War I for Woodrow Wilson to do much of the same thing, where the people were imprisoned during World War I for reading the Bill of Rights in public, for criticizing the conscription law. They were put in prison, things of that sort. In World War II, the Japanese Americans were rounded up by the thousands and placed in concentration camps. There was censorship. All of these things had as precedent the Lincoln regime. And the politicians used the Lincoln regime to, quote, justify, end quote, their behavior. Another aspect of all this, that, you know, this really did create executive dictatorship in America. And the war itself, of course, destroyed the system of federalism and states' rights that was established by the founders. And the states, all the states, North and South, really became mere appendages or franchisees of the government in Washington after the war. And the great literary critic Edmund Wilson made a very telling statement about this in one of his books on the Civil War. And I'd like to read it to you about the implications of this great centralization of power. He said, the impulse to unification was strong in the 19th century. And if unification means centralized governmental power as opposed to decentralized power or federalism. And if we would grasp the significance of the Civil War in relation to the history of our time today, we should consider Abraham Lincoln in connection with the other leaders who have been engaged in similar tasks. The chief of these leaders have been Bismarck and Lenin. They, with Lincoln, have presided over the unifications of the three great new modern powers. This is early 20th century, keep in mind. Each established a strong central government over hitherto loosely coordinated peoples. Lincoln kept the Union together by subordinating the South to the North. Bismarck imposed on the German states the cohesive hegemony of Prussia. Lenin began the work of binding Russia in a tight bureaucratic net. So he's not saying Lincoln is a mass murderer like Stalin. He's saying that these are these three major powers, Germany, Russia, and America, all went in the same direction in highly centralized government in different ways in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And the three people most responsible for this were Lincoln, Lenin, and Bismarck. More than anybody else. One more couple of quotes that some of you may be familiar with. that I'd like to bring to your attention about this. One second here. Is the famous correspondence between Lord Acton and Robert E. Lee. And Lord Acton is the well-known historian of liberty, the British historian of liberty. Many of you have probably heard his famous slogan about power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And he wrote a letter to Robert E. Lee, General Robert E. Lee, after the war. This was November 4th, 1866, where he's talking about the change in the constitutional configuration of the American government. And Lord Acton said this, "I saw in states' rights the only availing check upon the absolutism of the sovereign will, and secession filled me with hope not as a destruction, but as a redemption of democracy. The institutions of your republic have not exercised on the old world the salutary and liberating influence which ought to have belonged to them by reason of those defects and abuses of principle which the Confederate Constitution was expressly and wisely calculated to remedy." Now, the Confederate Constitution that Lord Acton is talking about did not have a general welfare clause, so it did not allow politicians to claim that just about anything promotes the general welfare. It outlawed protectionist tariffs altogether. It had only a 1 6-year term for the president. It allowed each state to abolish slavery on its own if it wanted to. The United States Constitution didn't do anything like that at the time. And so these are the types of things he's referring to. Lord Acton goes on to say, "I believe that the example of that great reform, the Confederate Constitution, would have blessed all the races of mankind by establishing true freedom purged of the native dangers and disorders of republics. Therefore, I deem that you are fighting the battles of our liberty, our progress, and our civilization. And I mourn for the state which was lost at Richmond, Virginia, more deeply than I rejoice over that which was saved at Waterloo." And then General Lee responded on December 15, 1866 by saying this, "While I have considered the preservation of the constitutional power of the general government to be the foundation of our peace and safety at home and abroad, I yet believe that the maintenance of the rights and authority reserved to the states and to the people," he's talking about the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, which was essentially destroyed by the war, "not only are essential to the adjustment and balance of the general system, but the safeguard to the continuance of a free government. I consider it as the chief source of stability to our political system, whereas the consolidation of the states into one vast republic, sure to be aggressive abroad and despotic at home, will be the certain precursor of that ruin which has overwhelmed all those that have preceded it." And that certainly was prescient, wasn't it? When Robert E. Lee said that the result of this war is going to be the consolidation of states into one vast republic, then it was. It became the United States is rather than the United States are, which is sure to be aggressive abroad and despotic at home. That is certainly true today. It will be the precursor of that ruin which has overwhelmed all those that have preceded it. And so I think Lee was prescient there in saying that. And of course, everybody knew at the time that all the other countries of the world ended slavery peacefully. This included New England, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and so forth. In fact, before the war started, Ulysses S. Grant was the overseer of a slave plantation in Ohio, in southern Ohio. His father-in-law owned a slave plantation, and he hired his son-in-law, Ulysses S. Grant, who was not in the army at the time, to be the overseer. You look it up on the web, and the web called the National Park Service refers to Grant as the manager. But he wasn't at the time. The so-called managers of slave plantations were called overseers. They were not called managers. And so everybody understood that places like Ohio ended slavery peacefully. It was only the Lincoln regime that used the slaves as political pawns in a war. It was not really about them. And so I think I'll quit about there. I think that's about what I wanted to say in my usual 45-minute talk about Lincoln and the Constitution. And so we'll do what we usually do, and I'll do my best to answer whatever questions you might have. You know, Cam is doing his usual great job. Yeah, Patriotic War is the title of Edmund Wilson's book that I quoted from. I'll see if anybody has any questions. I don't compare Lincoln to Stalin, Malcolm is asking. I quoted Edmund Wilson as saying, Lincoln ushered in the centralized bureaucratic state in America, and Stalin and Lenin did the same thing in Russia. And that's not the same thing as comparing him to Stalin as a person. And no, I haven't done that. I haven't compared them policy-wise. I think that would be kind of futile to do that. No one would pay attention to that, in my view. Let's see, Travis is asking, it sounds like the Republican Party has always been a party of mercantilism and corporatism. That is absolutely correct. The Republican Party was the remnants of the old Whig Party, primarily. The old Whig Party was the party of the northern moneyed elite, the banking industry, northern manufacturers, and so forth, the railroad corporations. Lincoln was a wealthy railroad lawyer. And it was the Democratic Party of the 19th century that was the party of Jefferson. And so the Democratic Party, by the time you get to the 1896 election, was taken over by the Progressive. And so it moved into a much more statist party and became totally different at the turn of the 20th century. But the Republican Party always was the party of mercantilism, crony capitalism, if you will, with a few minor deviations of some good things in terms of free markets that were done during the early 1920s and on a few other occasions. Eisenhower was a pretty good Republican president. He cut spending. He cut the military by 40% during his terms in office. And so you can point to some individual Republicans, but still, as you see to this day, the Republican Party is today what it was when in its beginnings, the party of crony capitalism, as is the Democratic Party. Let's see, Byron is asking a question about the southern states. Lincoln never considered secession to be illegal. He never considered the southern states to be out of the Union. Therefore, in his mind, the southern states were American states, and he was waging war on them. Therefore, he was committing treason in his own mind by his own actions, because he never admitted that secession was legal or constitutional. So the best way to explain secession, Tim is asking, in a few words, freedom of association. The Declaration of Independence says that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. The American Union was a voluntary union at the beginning. That means the citizens of the states have a right to join or not to join. It's very telling that in 1861, there were several proposed laws in Congress to make secession illegal. Now, why do you suppose this would have been? Why do you suppose members of Congress would have proposed laws making secession illegal if it was already illegal? Well, the obvious answer is that everybody, every last person knew it was legal. The Union was voluntary. The Founding Fathers did not adopt a Soviet-style union. It was the Soviet Union that was held together at gunpoint. It was the Soviets who, when the Czechs protested in the 1950s, brought in the tanks and who held their union together with tanks and guns. But the original American Union was a voluntary union. Article 7 of the Constitution explains that it is to be ratified. The Constitution is to be ratified by the voluntary actions of the states through state political conventions. If the understanding of the American founders was that if any state wanted to secede in the future, that the federal government would therefore have a right to invade that state, murder its citizens by the tens of thousands, rape its women, plunder its property, carrying off millions of dollars of private property, and burn its cities to the ground, there never would have been a constitution. Nobody would have ratified a constitution if that was the understanding. That was Abraham Lincoln's understanding. That was his theory of what the Constitution really says. And that's why you have the propaganda arms of the Republican Party today, like Hillsdale College and the Claremont Institute, still repeating the Lincoln argument that the federal government has a state to has a right to murder its own citizens if they secede. And so, and it is just truly evil, as far as I'm concerned, to me to make that argument. You don't have to make an eloquent legalistic argument for the right of secession if you could also make the argument against mass murder. After all, to say that the citizens of the states do not have a right to secede in the context of quoting Abe Lincoln is to say that the government then did have a right to mass murder 300 or 400,000 of its own citizens just to keep them as a part of this political arrangement, and first and foremost, to keep them paying federal taxes. That's the argument you have to make the argument against secession, that you are in favor of using the government that pledges to protect the constitutional liberties of all citizens. Every congressman, every president takes that oath, and that you have to make the argument that part of that oath includes mass murdering citizens who no longer consent to being governed by Washington, D.C. Larry's asking about the purpose of the deification of Lincoln. Well, it's not Lincoln's actions. Nobody knows these things. These things aren't taught in the public schools. It's a faux history that you are taught. You feed the slaves. I even had one of my talks I gave. I had this elderly man who looked like he's at least 75 or 80 years old say the only comment he could make at the end of my talk was, "But Lincoln was a kind-hearted man." That's what he was taught in elementary school. He was taught he cried when he saw a turkey die. There's a story about that. He saw a turkey die and he just went to pieces about it. And that's the sort of crap that children are taught about Lincoln. They're not taught these things that we're talking about in this class. That's why we teach classes like this. But all these things are in the university libraries. They're not in the junior high school textbooks, unless you buy Gerald Dwyer's book, which I would recommend as a high school textbook the war between the states. But the mainstream regime supporting textbooks don't mention any of these things. Let's see, Lincoln's murderer. Well, John Wilkes Booth was from Maryland. If he was the man, he was a Marylander, which most Marylanders were Southerners at the time. Maryland was occupied by the federal government, but more than half of the men from Maryland who fought in the American Civil War fought on the side of the Confederacy. I don't think I could answer Malcolm's question. I'm not equipped to answer that. I'm not a lawyer or a legal scholar. So Malcolm's question about Hopp versus United States, I'm just not familiar with it. Let's see. Yeah, Larry commented that Lincoln knew at some point secession was legal. Yeah, it's true. He did make a speech in 1848 criticizing President Polk in the Mexican War by saying that states have a right to secede. But there is a weasel word in that statement of his. He says, whenever they have the power to do so. And to me, that is a very creepy weasel word, because he's sort of, even at that time, 1848, he's saying, well, yes, the government is voluntary. Everybody knows the union is voluntary. And if you have the power to secede, you have the right to secede. And so it really is, when you think about it, is a might makes right argument. Meaning, if at some future date, if we, the federal government, have the power to stop you from seceding, then you no longer have the right to secede. So that's how I interpret Lincoln's 1848 statement, where he said the people might have a right to secede. Okay, Malcolm was asking about the word happiness. The traditional Lockean natural rights theory said that the primary purpose of governments instituted among men is the protection of life, liberty, and property. But of course, Jefferson put happiness in there instead of property. And I'm not sure I can answer the question of what people at the time thought of happiness, other than what we would think of it as today, the pursuit of happiness. And Charles Murray wrote a book called In Pursuit of Happiness and Good Government, and which is a really good book about the crowding out of the civil society by government programs. And so on that general topic, I would look at that. There's a very insidious type of research called happiness research in the economics profession now. Go to Mises.org and look for my article on happiness research. It's a pretty scathing critique of this, and I don't have time now to get into all my critiques of so-called happiness research, but you can find it. Let me see if I can see the exact title for you. It's also a chapter of my book, Organized Crime. Let's see. I think I've called it the Trojan Horse of Happiness Research on Mises.org a few years ago. So you can look at it. There it is. Cam found it already. Well, Larry's asking about why the Lincoln apologists like Spielberg, who have money and power, have the fear. I think Spielberg has the agenda of promoting Obama. When he made this movie, one of the themes of his movie is how Lincoln skirted the law, how he did a lot of the things that I talked about tonight. And I think what Spielberg has in mind is encouraging the Obama administration to be more like Lincoln, and constitution, schmonstitution, to establish a dictatorship. Even Woody Allen, who was quoted in the newspapers a couple of years ago, he said, no, now that we have power, we should just ignore Congress. Now that a liberal like me is in there, a socialist like me, Woody Allen said, is in there, we should just ignore Congress and do whatever we want. And I think that's what Spielberg is up to. Yeah, he has money, but there's this pesky thing about having three branches of government and not just one. And so I think that's his agenda. Let's see, Dennis wants to know if I'll write a second edition of How Capitalism Saved America. No, but I'm not planning on it, but Lou Rockwell has a book coming out soon called Fascism, American Fascism versus Capitalism. And so it'll be complementary to my book, How Capitalism Saved America, I think. Travis wants to know how the right wingers can call themselves capitalists when they are really mercantilists. So, well, I suppose they can call themselves whatever they want to call themselves. and confuse everybody. But that's one of the reasons I've written all these books, my Lincoln books, two of them, my book on Hamilton, How Capitalism Saved America, all distinguish between capitalism and crony capitalism or mercantilism, because the criticisms of government policy that we say are often criticisms of capitalism rhetorically, but it's not capitalism that is the problem. It's crony capitalism, and it's the Fed and interventionism that is the problem. And so apparently, you know, these right-wingers who support the Republican Party regime, for example, on the radio and the television and elsewhere, they aren't supporting capitalism for sure. They might be practicing it by selling books and coffee mugs and ball caps, but ideologically they're not. Well, capitalism in the simplest words is mutually advantageous trade between consenting adults based on the division of labor, and it's peaceful exchange. That's capitalism. That's all. It's not special favors created by the Fed or by the Department of Commerce or by Congress. It's not subsidies. It's not bailouts. It's the thing that you and I engage in every single day when we buy a coffee or a beer or a carton of milk. It's mutually advantageous trade between consenting adults. That's capitalism. Malcolm wants me to discuss how the prisons in Europe were empty to send to the States to fight the war. Well, yeah, there's a book by a military historian. Let me get the exact title of the book about this. Let me get you the exact citation here. Mark Grimsley is the author, and the name of his book is The Hard Hand of War, Union Military Policy Towards Southern Civilians. And this is one place. It's written, you can find this in other places, but it's one place where you can read about how many of the mercenaries that fought in Lincoln's army were criminals from Europe who were promised land under the Homestead Act, and so I came to America and were part of Lincoln's army. Let me see if I can find a quote. Now, but anyway, that's the source, and he does document that a lot of the mercenaries were terrorists, essentially, from the prisons. These are the people that joined Sherman's army and pillaged and plundered their way through the South at the end of the war. Let's see. Well, it might take me too long to find the actual quote here about this. But that's the author, Mark Grimsley. S.C. Kim found the book. Travis is asking about people who use the phrase free market. Yeah, I've talked to libertarians over the years who have said we should use capitalism. Capitalism was the word used by Karl Marx. I mean, he wanted people to think that only the owners of capital benefit from capitalism and not the consumers and the workers. And so it's been a biased term for a long, long time. And so there's nothing wrong with using free market or voluntary exchange or the voluntary society. civil society. Let's see, Malcolm Arnold is asking about the arrest warrants. Well, those references I mentioned, the biography of Ward Lehman, biography of the mayor of Baltimore, the memoirs of Benjamin Robbins Curtis, and the official history of the Federal Marshal Service. That's four pretty darn good sources about the arrest warrant for Judge Taney. And so I'm not sure you know, how much more would you need. That's certainly there's a lot. I don't know if there's more research on this or not. I wrote an article on Mises.org some years ago on Moronomics about Michael Moore. I see some of you are talking about Michael Moore. Malcolm is asking about the Middle States. Well, yeah, there's a book by William C. Wright called The Secession Movement in the Middle Atlantic States, W-R-I-G-H-T, right? And it's about how New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Delaware were considered the Middle States in 1860. And there were big movements there that either supported Southern secession. They either supported those states joining the Southern Confederacy or creating a confederacy of their own. So all of these people had in common that they hated the New England Yankees. Not all Northerners were Yankees. I'll refer you to an article by Clyde Wilson called The Yankee Problem in America that describes what a Yankee was. And he says in it that Hillary Clinton would be a museum-quality specimen of a Yankee. Sort of an imperious person, an arrogant person who thinks that he or she has the right to impose his or her will on the whole world by gunpoint if necessary. This is sort of the mindset, sort of the neo-Puritanism that grew up in parts of New England and spread to the upper Midwest, and Lincoln was their man. He was like them. It really is the American version of the totalitarian mindset. And that's where that comes from, in my view. And so the Middle Atlantic secessionists, they understood this, and they didn't want to be part of a government anymore either that was dominated by New England and New Englanders from the Midwest. And so, but as soon as Lincoln went and invaded Maryland and they saw the death and destruction that could come to their states, that movement broke up. But there is a book about it. Cam found it on Amazon. Okay, Tim is asking, was Lincoln's War Department infested with Marxists from Europe? Well, yeah, there were quite a few Marxists in Lincoln's army, who were part of the revolutions in Europe in 1848 and failed to create sort of socialist utopias there, and so they came here. And quite a few of his generals were German speakers. And Siegel was a well-known general of Lincoln. There's a book called Melting Pot Soldiers that is about this. And there's another book more recently about, I think it's called Lincoln's Marxists, that talks about all of this. Yeah, I highly recommend The Yankee Problem in America by Clyde Wilson. It really explains a lot about the mindset that led to the American Civil War and still exists in a very powerful way today. Deborah is asking how the Lincoln era nationalism became the MO of the modern day Democrats. Well, the nationalism led to mind-boggling riches for the military-industrial complex. And mind-boggling riches for the beneficiaries of corporate welfare. And so nationalism, if you will, has always been sort of a smokescreen for the dispensation of favors to politically connected corporations, who then kick back the money to finance the political careers of the politicians who dispense the favors. And so the Democrats play the same game as the Republicans in that regard. Let's see, what other questions do I have? Malcolm is asking about disagreement among the general staff. One of my articles on lewrockwell.com, a short article, is a review of a book on called Desertion During the Civil War, and the author is Ella Lon, L-O-N-N, and she talks about massive desertion of tens of thousands of soldiers in Lincoln's army on the eve of battle. In some cases, 60 or 70,000 deserters on the eve of some of the big battles like Antietam and places like that. And of course, many of these were officers. And so the acts of desertion were certainly an expression of dissent. You had the New York City draft riots, and you had draft riots in other places that were expressions of dissent. That's what the Copperheads were all about. And so, yeah, but I don't know of any book or that I could point to off the top of my head about this. Let's see if there's anything under the Q&A here. Not really. Things on the chat. Well, things seem to be slowing down a little bit. Well, maybe we'll call it a night then. It looks like we run out of gas. It's about a quarter of. That's the usual routine. So thanks again for participating. I'll be back here same time, same place tomorrow night for our regular class on Lincoln as the founding father of the American warfare state. And so I'll see you, you'll see me anyway, tomorrow evening again. And have a good night.